I have, for the next several Sundays, put aside Genesis, and we are in Advent season. So this, the next several Sundays, it has been suggested to me, and I usually generally follow suggestions, that I do different songs, Christmas songs, as messages, as rather than doing the Christmas story. So, and this Sunday, as you probably have figured out, it is O Come Emmanuel. And I'm going to tell a little story here in the beginning. Just as a minister began his Christmas Eve service, the electricity in the church failed. The ushers and the minister found some candles and placed them around the sanctuary. And then he re-entered the pulpit, shuffled his papers and notes, and muttered, "Now where was I?" And a tired voice cried out, "Right near the end."
No.
I'm not going to read scripture today because I'm going to use the lyrics of the hymn, O Come Emmanuel. The one we sang is not really the true version, I guess the true version, if there is such a thing as a true version of it. It's a scaled down version of it. The real, what we are left with is seven stanzas or verses, and we only sang four, and I'll get into a little bit more why and what for and the theological perspectives of the lyrics. The reason I'm not reading any scripture, because there's scripture that is attached to it, I have a little problem with how we have Christianized the Old Testament to try to excerpt things out that mean point to Jesus. And like in this case here, what is attached to this, I think, is Isaiah 7, somewhere around 13-14. It says, "Therefore God himself will give you a sign. A virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and you will call his name Emmanuel." But that's in the middle of a whole set of ideas and thoughts that are disregarded in order to point, to use excerpt this text out to say this is a prophetic word of Jesus coming. I'm not denying that that is not so. I'm just not sure that the process in which it's done is totally correct. If you're going to use that process in Christianizing the Old Testament, then you should also look at the richness of the text that goes around it. So in the very next sentence, in verse 15, it goes on, "He will be eating curds and honey," and goes on. And to me, that moves to a different voice in the text, and that is talking about John the Baptist. So within this chapter, there are several voices speaking. It's not just one voice speaking. So I have a little issue with, I don't say it's really an issue, I don't know if I quite agree with how they do this, even though they do it. And if they do, and we open it up so that it speaks in various different ways, in endless ways, then we shouldn't close the text off and just say that it only means one certain thing. You have to look at the richness of the text and understand the richness of the text also. But generally speaking, that's not done. They excerpt out what they want and leave the rest behind. And I think there's something lost in that whole process. And so I'm reluctant to say, well, this means that Jesus, talking about Jesus here, at the exclusiveness of the rest of the text. So I'm not saying that it doesn't. But that's my little rant for the day. These are the times in our lives each year when we pause and to reflect and to remember. We look back on the past. Maybe not so much on our personal lives, but on a bigger picture. We start contemplating a Jesus picture or a Christmas picture of some sort. And what are our lives without a bigger picture? You know, we have a value. I think there's a certain value in understanding the singleness of our individualness along in a bigger picture of things. Without it, it's just a merely moment in time. A candle that burns amongst many is easily missed, individual candles lit and placed in a well-lit room. So, you know, sometimes we forget that we are, many candles lit, and we forget the individuality also. Christmas is about a God who remembered each candle that ever burned, or is burning, or ever burned. And St. John wrote that Jesus was the light that came here. It's a spiritual light to light the world. And so this morning I want to study the song, O Come, O Come Emmanuel. And I'm going to read the lyrics in which I want to speak from. It has seven stanzas. O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lonely exile here until the Son of God appear. And then there's a refrain. Verse 2, stanza 2. O come, O wisdom from on high, who ordered all things mightily, to us a path of knowledge show, and teach us its way to go. 3. O come, great Lord of might, who to your tribes on Sinai height in ancient time did give the law in cloud and majesty and awe. 4. O come, O branch of Jesse's stem, unto your own and rescue them. From the depths of hell your people save, and give them victory over the grave. 5. O come, O key of David, come and open wide our heavenly home. Make safe for us the heavenward road, and bar the way to death's abode. 6. O come, O bright and morning star, and bring us comfort from afar. Dispel the shadows of night, and turn our darkness into light. 7. O come, O King of nations, bind in one the hearts of all mankind. Bid all our sad divisions cease, and be yourself our King of peace. And that was written in by John Mason Neal in 1861. Now, there is a rich history of this song. This is one of the oldest Christmas songs that we have. And it was written, as I said, around 1861. And during that time, that there was Christmas wasn't always celebrated the way it was now. We think Christmas has been a happy time the whole way through, but it hasn't. There was times when the church actually said, you don't celebrate Christmas. It was denied for Christians to celebrate because it became too much of a drunken party. And during this time of when this was written, or there was an effort to try to reestablish Christmas in a religious fashion. Charles Dickinson, the way I understand, when he wrote The Christmas Story, Christmas was not in really good favor at the time. And his story helped to promote and move Christmas in a more positive way. So it's a time when this is written, is really a great upheaval within the church. There is within the song, "O come, O come," this meteorological mathematical rhythm that is written into the text comes from a long time back. They don't really know quite sure when that, when this mathematical rhythm of music has that, been put forth. The use of the word O is very mystical, and it was written in a sense to be like a prayer or a meditative chant. It wasn't necessarily a song. So the use of this mathematical rhythm that is placed in the song has been around and used in combination to a lot of words other than what is here. The O is something that kind of like places you in a meditative state. If you say it as a prayer, it's kind of like a, we had a discussion about this. But it's almost like the sound of like that the Eastern religions say about the om. It's a prayerful, meditative way to put you in a state of mind. And that's what the use of the word O is. So to help you move in that way. So, and no one really knows where that come from either. So it has a long history of things such as that. Now, when Neil wrote this, John Mason Neal put this together in 1861, he only put 5 stanzas in it. That's it. That's all that was in it. And then in 1916, Henry Coffin put in the last 2 stanzas, verse 6 and 7. Now, my opinion of all the study that I did on it and my reflection upon the first 5 have a heavy nationalistic, Jewish nationalism to it. There is a certain ransom captive Israel. There is this lonely mourning. In my opinion, it's probably may have been written by a Jewish person who was mourning the time of exile. So I'm not sure that, because they don't know where it actually all came from. They don't know it from about 18-something back. They don't know where it really came from, the words, and there's different versions of it along the way. But the basic theme of the first 5 is a heavy nationalistic restoration, or you can see it as the return of Jesus also. So if you see it in the early Christian church, you would see Israel as the church, and you would move that to a time of a restoration of all mankind. But it definitely has a heavy, for me, a nationalistic point of view. And that's okay. I'm not saying that makes it invalid or anything like that, because it talks about the coming of Jesus and a path of wisdom. And so each stanza is supposed to illustrate an attribute of God. So there's 5 different attributes that are listed within the first 5 stanzas. So there's a lot in the text. The idea, again, like a history of Israel is written in there. So the tribes of Sinai, the ancient law is given, the branch of Jesse, which is supposedly referring to the Messiah, and rescuing us from the depths of hell, and the key of David, on and on it goes until you get to verse 6 and 7. I see this as a more universalist point of view that was added towards in the end of the last 2 verses. There is a universal salvation type of that is added. Oh, come bright and morning star. Now, that is referred to as Jesus. Revelation refers to Jesus as the bright and morning star. There are different levels of stars. There is the dawn star, the morning star, the day star, and there's just plain old stars. These are different angelic beings and the levels and the hierarchies that exist in the heavens. And bright and morning star is a reference to the highest known star category, to speak in plain English, that we know, and that's where Jesus is placed. Jesus is placed in this high level of bright and morning star. So he says, oh, come bright and morning star, bring us comfort from afar, dispel the depths, the shadows of night, and turn our darkness into light. Isn't that what Jesus did? Jesus came here and said to us, turn our darkness to light, to give us hope. Isn't that what Christmas is about? Hope, and hope of the future, bringing light to the world. And then for me, the last stanza really puts out the idea of universal salvation for sure. And I was really, when I read it the first time, I said, wow, that's really quite, you know, and for 1900s, early 1900s, that's really a really progressive idea that this gentleman is putting into the song. O come King of Nations. So now Jesus becomes, or this Messiah becomes King of the nations of the world. Bind in one the hearts of all mankind. So we're supposed to have coming together nationally around the globe, come together as all one mankind or humankind. That's an idea which I promote and I think is what Jesus is all about, bringing the world together under different and without enmity, which is what we were studying in Genesis a while back, which after the new year I'm going to go back to it again, so don't think I deserted it. But it said, bid all our said divisions cease. Now just that idea alone, all our divisions cease. I mean, wow. Isn't that, does it mean that we all should be the same and think the same? No. We can be totally different and get along. But my thing is, you got to pull that enmity out. You got to pull that out and say, okay, it's okay to be different. And these divisions, I mean, look around our world today. I mean, come on, I'm not even going to go there. There's so much division anymore, it's unbelievable. Even within the church, we can't get things in the right order. And for this gentleman to write this in this way in the early 1900s is really kind of profound, I think, in a way that is, should be carried on. And it says, to be yourself our King of Peace. Isn't this what the whole Christmas story is about? Bringing peace to the world. And this gentleman wrote this stuff in a universal way, I think is, again, astounding. I don't know if I have any more.